From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's edition of Fresh Air, I talk with conductor Leonard Slatkin, the music director of the St. Louis Symphony. Under his baton, the symphony has become one of the finest orchestras in the country. Also today, I talk with New Yorker magazine reporter Kennedy Fraser. Her beat is The World of High Fashion. A collection of her essays titled Scenes from the Fashionable World has just been published. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews new recordings of Beethoven's Symphony Cycles, both played on original instruments. And language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg talks about the jargon of the corporate world. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. My guest is conductor Leonard Slatkin. As music director and principal conductor of the St. Louis Symphony, Slatkin is one of the few American-born conductors to conduct a major American symphony. Since he took over the St. Louis Symphony in 1979, he transformed it into one of the country's leading orchestras. In a 1983 Time magazine article, music critic Michael Walsh rated the St. Louis Symphony second only to Chicago's. Leonard Slatkin describes himself as a generalist with a bias toward Russian and German repertory. The St. Louis Symphony has earned wide praise for its interpretations of Rachmaninoff, Vaughan Williams, and Sibelius. But Slatkin has also introduced more contemporary works into the repertoire and has commissioned new music for the orchestra. It was he who commissioned David Del Tredici to write In Memory of a Summer Day, which won the 1980 Pulitzer Prize for Music. Leonard Slatkin was raised in a musical home. His father Felix was a concertmaster for the 20th century Fox Orchestra, and also directed the Hollywood Bowl Symphony, and his mother Eleanor was first cellist for the Warner Brothers Orchestra. Before we meet Leonard Slatkin, let's listen to a passage from David Del Tredici's In Memory of a Summer Day, featuring Leonard Slatkin conducting the St. Louis Symphony. That's a piece that Leonard Slatkin commissioned David Del Tredici to write. Leonard Slatkin, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Before we talk about your life and your career, I just have to ask you about the terrific clanging sound in the piece that we just heard.
The loud sound that you heard is actually two very thick steel plates played by one person and hit with a very hard wooden mallet. And we found, for purposes of recording anyway, that the best thing was to put these things out in the audience so he could hit them as hard as he wanted without really destroying any of the musicians' ears who were sitting directly in front. That has become a very big issue with many orchestras in this country, the impact of loud sounds on musicians who, people forget, they make their living with their hands, but they also make it with their ears.
Right. You are one of the few American conductors to conduct a major American orchestra. And I wonder if you think it's a question of talent or a question of cultural bias. The fact that there are so few American-born conductors heading symphonies in this country.
A few years ago, I would have said bias, because you had a much more European-oriented set of board of directors of almost every orchestra in this country. And there were leanings that if you had a particular demeanor or a particular accent, you must have been a superior musician. That's many years ago. Now, I think things have begun to swing a little bit the other way, in the sense of Americans are not thought of, in fact, I don't think music directors are thought of because of their nationalities anymore. However, the truth remains that there are still not very many Americans that head up major American orchestras. One of the things that makes it truly interesting, however, is the fact that no country that I can think of really does seem to serve its own very well. In London, for example, the five major British orchestras, none of them are headed up by an English conductor. In Vienna, both the opera and the Philharmonic are not headed up by an Austrian. In Paris, the two major orchestras there, neither is headed by a French person. So I think each country somehow feels that maybe something outside may be good. Ultimately, each city has to decide really who the best musician is, not the nationality. So I'm not concerned that way. I do get concerned that in this country we don't produce the level of conductors that, for the size of population we have, we should be producing. I find a lot of younger conductors just anxious to grab one of the big orchestras without really having worked their way through the smaller ones. I find people who are having a great desire to show off their interpretive abilities in a Mahler or a Bruckner symphony, but who can't get through a Chopin piano concerto.
Are there cultural or musical reasons behind that?
I think the cultural ones are very evident in the sense of our whole society moves so fast that we don't allow ourselves the time to grow. And the musical reasons have to do with the accessibility of so much music on the air and on discs of all kinds that we have tended to learn superficially in the last 10 to 15 years, certainly. It's important to hear what other people do with works, but only after you have studied and learned them yourself. This has to do not just with conductors, but virtually everybody else in the musical world.
Do you think that your approach to conducting is any different by virtue of being American? Do you think that the American approach is any different than the European approach to conducting?
Conducting per se, no, but the technique of rehearsal, yes. In this country, we don't have the luxury of a lot of rehearsal time for concerts. Certainly, summer music is the best example of that. Most festivals operate with one, maybe two rehearsals at the most for a concert, and many times you have the case of having to prepare three different programs and, say, four rehearsals altogether. In this country, we have to learn to be efficient. We have to learn to use our rehearsal time very carefully, choose our words very carefully with an orchestra. Sometimes in Europe, I have the, I suppose you could call it a plus, of having 9, 10, 11 rehearsals for a concert. I find it a detriment because you wind up spending most of your time with the orchestra teaching the notes. In this country, there's a greater degree of proficiency upon arrival at first rehearsal. The good orchestras in this country, not just the great ones, the good ones, know the notes of the pieces to start with. So you work just on the musical elements of phrasing and breathing and dynamics and things that you want to inject into a work. In Europe, it's very much a teaching process. I think it's one of the reasons that some of the European conductors, especially Eastern European ones, who appear in this country, have difficulty with American orchestras because they're coming in expecting to tell them certain things which the orchestra already knows.
If you don't mind my commenting on this, you strike me as a very informal kind of person, and maybe it's just a stereotype that I have in my mind that doesn't exist that much in the real world, but I think many of us tend to think of conductors as just much more formal than you appear
to be. I'm not very formal, no. I just left my jeans at home. So, again, I think because the stereotype of the past in particular with that older European image, mm-hmm. Is something that it's beginning to fade a bit. You'll even find some of the great conductors in this country of European extraction also a little casual. Zubin Mehta can be a very casual and relaxed person, as can Sir George Scholte. These people can be very calm and normal. If they're just walking on the street, if you didn't recognize them, you certainly wouldn't say, aha, there goes a conductor. In the older days of a Stokowski and a Toscanini, no, they were cultivating that image. There was a real image there. Nowadays, I think a lot of us, because of the recognition factor of the video and news broadcasts. We prefer to be casual just so we're not recognized. I like it when I can go out in my own city in St. Louis and just hide among a crowd and not be recognized. I prefer that as to having people coming up all the time. I like to just be a normal person and go to the movies like everybody else.
Conductor Leonard Slatkin is my guest, and he's the music director of the St. Louis Symphony. You've commissioned several American composers.
Three a year.
To do pieces. That's a lot.
Yeah.
Tell me if you worry when you commission someone that you might not like the piece. I ask this because even the greatest artists have works that they do that don't measure up to their own standard. And also, I think, in everybody's body of work, there's pieces you like more and pieces you like less. And you have part of your reputation and a lot of your money on the line when you commission somebody to write something.
You raise a very good point. And it is, at best, a very knowledgeable gamble. What I try to do when I commission the works, first of all, is to deal with composers whose music and style I know quite well, and to kind of assume that I will get a continuing growth from previous works, as opposed to somebody who is going to say, aha, I'm going to change styles on you just like that. The other part is I never offer a restriction on a composer. I say, please write me a piece and do whatever you want to do. Here's the size of the orchestra. If you want to use some saxes, if you want to use the chorus, use a chorus. I don't even offer a time restriction. They can do whatever they want to do. And for the most part, I have not been let down or disappointed. Obviously, some works are going to be better than others. And some pieces I'll play the one time and then not take them around. On the other hand, I find that most of the pieces that I've been commissioning recently, I'm comfortable with and have enjoyed taking to other orchestras. I get criticized a lot because my taste in American contemporary music runs a little bit on the conservative side. It is not of the more intellectual qualities as, say, a Wuranen or an Elliot Carter or Milton Babbitt. It just doesn't run that way for me. Doesn't mean I don't have great respect and admiration. It's just not comfortable for me. No one person can do everything. So I have been concentrating more on composers who have a more immediate communication to their audience. Del Tredici was a good example because he kind of paved the way for many composers. The piece that you heard at the beginning was one of several works he was writing on the subject matter of Alice in Wonderland. And when he wrote a piece in 1976 for the Chicago Symphony called Final Alice, he broke ground because he had literally, in big symphonic terms, revived what essentially was a tradition of Strauss and Mahler, big tunes, sweeping orchestrations, but yet with a kind of 80s language and late 70s language. And it was a big hit. Critics liked it. Audiences liked it. Even the orchestras enjoyed playing it. It was a kind of signal for other composers to say, it's okay for an audience to accept your music on first hearing. Now, David, of course, in that sense, is quite reactionary. The composers I've been championing recently are people like Joseph Schwantner, Joan Tower, John Harbison, Christopher Rouse, Stephen Stuckey, Donald Erb. And their music, for me, has an immediate appeal to an audience. And I'm comfortable with this music. And that's the important thing. I present it not because it's new, not because it's a novelty, but I think their music has a great chance to survive and be understood by audiences.
I get the impression that as a conductor, you think it's part of your responsibility to broaden the repertoire by commissioning new works.
That's part of it, but it's also a commitment of being an American artist and understanding that out there are wonderful composers that we need to start having our own traditions established now, get them started now so it's understood in this country there are terrific people. Given the choice between asking a comparable European and comparable American to write a piece for me, I'm going to go to the American without question, the same as I would in most instances on soloist and guest conductors.
And why would you go to the American and not the European?
Because I think we have an obligation to present the finest talent we have in this country if it's of comparable quality. And that is a purely subjective decision on my part or whoever would be the director at the time.
There is a fear, I think, in the classical music world that people who go to concerts want to hear what they already know and love, or lesser-known works by composers who they already know and love. Mm-hmm. Have you had success in integrating in new compositions?
I haven't had much of a problem with it because I find that if I'm presenting a work which presents serious listening challenges, difficulties even, that go above what might be in the printed program note and just above a first hearing, I will take the time to talk to the audience about the work, what to listen for in it, perhaps play a little bit of examples, express the philosophy of the work. Recently I did a piece by a young man who lives in Louisville called Claude Baker, and the work is called The Glass Bead Game. And it is based on the novel of the same name, and it tries to present in musical images what the novel does. The utopian society is so based in intellectual pursuits that it forgets about the looking forward to the future. And it was very important to parallel certain elements of the work, the written work, and the musical one, and to understand that there is a philosophical method in this piece, and if they listened to it with that in mind, they would get it. Another piece recently was a work by a young man named Stephen Martland called Baba Yar, and although we have a Shostakovich symphony based on the same premise, the Shostakovich is based on a poem, and this is based on the actual problem of the concentration camp located in Russia with massive deaths occurring, and it's a half hour of brutality in this piece, unrelenting, extremely difficult. And I wanted to impress on the audience that if their minds moved away during the course of the work, if it was thinking about other things, try to focus back on what the subject matter was. And for a piece that was really hard to listen to, I was astounded at the audience reception and reaction to it. So I have no problem with trying to communicate verbally to the audience what they're about to hear. Let them conjure up their own pictures, certainly, but at the same time, help them. I mean, we need that as musicians ourselves. We need to know what's going on. Certainly the audience does.
Yeah. Well, you know, I want to talk to you about your musical background, but first we're going to take a short break. My guest is conductor Leonard Slatkin, and we'll be back after this. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live from WHYY in Philadelphia and is distributed by National Public Radio.
Conductor Leonard Slatkin is my guest. He's the music director of the St. Louis Symphony Orchestra. I'd like to talk with you about your musical background. You were born into a musical family. Your father was the concertmaster at 20th Century Fox, directed the Hollywood Bowl. Your mother was a cellist with the Warner Orchestra. One of the first things that comes to my mind is that the studio orchestras they played with don't exist anymore. There's no such thing anymore.
No. It was an amazing time, the 40s and 50s. All 11 studios in Hollywood each had their own separate orchestras, just like you have a Philadelphia or New York Philharmonic. Each one was separate. They had their set of services, and they were remarkable orchestras. Each studio had its own composers. Max Steiner and Korngold were over there at Warner Brothers. Alfred Newman was there at Fox. Nicholas Rocha was, MGM? Whatever it was. It was an amazing time. And then, of course, the McCarthy folks wiped that out in 53, and instead of a lot of people working, just a handful were doing all the studios. It was a great time, though.
Did it develop a taste for, did you develop a taste because of your parents for film music and for music with epic and dramatic sweep like most film music had?
I developed, I don't know if I call it a taste for it, but I developed a very wide-ranging set of musical interests. It was not uncommon at our house that Frank Sinatra would be over one night and Stravinsky the next and Danny Kaye the next. And I mean, we never knew from night to night who was going to be dropping by. My father was very involved in the popular end as well as the classical end. He had the Hollywood Bowl. He was one of the co-founders of Liberty Records with Julie London and all those folks. He did arrangements. It was a very, very busy time and very exciting.
You know, so frequently when a youngster is learning how to play an instrument, they're trotted out for the relatives and neighbors and visitors to play a piece. Did that ever happen in
yeah.
your family?
It did? Oh, yeah. Or? The difference was we were trotted out for only relatives because everybody were musicians. And there's a wonderful picture I keep in my mind. I was studying piano. My brother was studying cello. I had a cousin who was studying violin. My brother was studying with my grandfather, and my cousin was studying with my father, and I was studying with my uncle, if everybody can straighten that out. My brother would take a lesson on Sundays in one of the rooms in the house. My cousin would be in another room with my father, and I'd be taking a piano lesson with my uncle. And then we'd come downstairs and have to play trios. And the three of us would sit there, little kids, and on this long couch were the four teachers. And we always knew it was going to be an easy afternoon because we'd start, play two or three bars, and the four teachers would start arguing. My uncle going, piano needs to be louder. My father going, no, no, it's covering up the violin, the cello is doing this. And we just sat there. We knew it would be fun. We got to play for other people, usually in the film industry, actually, other musicians. We'd come out and play. And actually, one of the biggest treats I ever had, my parents had a wonderful ensemble called the Hollywood String Quartet. I mean, really brilliant quartet. And once my father let me play the first violin at a rehearsal when I studied violin and sit in with these people, it was... That was exciting for me.
Did you have to perform when Frank Sinatra came over?
Once.
Really?
Yeah. Big deal. Only time I ever got excited was when I met Doris Day. All these other people were Schoenberg, Stravinsky, big deal. Doris Day, that was something.
Why did she excite you?
I don't know. I was a little kid. I thought she was great. That's what movie stars were about. Who needed all these other folks?
Did your parents stay out of your way musically?
Not really. In fact, there was a time when they so much impressed on us the fact that being a musician was not an easy life, and they discouraged us. So I remember once playing baseball outside with my friends. My mother, when I returned home, said, you didn't finish your practicing. I said, no, I wanted to play baseball. She says, that means more to you than your music? I said, yes. And she locked the piano for 3 or 4 days. And I was happy. I thought, this is going to be great. I'm going to be a ball player. It'll be no problem. And ultimately, I wanted the piano and just screamed and hollered and carried on until I got it back. And I think what they were saying is, if you really want to be a musician, you had better love it, because it's going to take a lot of your life.
But there was no halfway. You either had to commit to being a musician or give it up.
That's right. No halfway. It was what they would call old school. You don't see much of that anymore. These days, I think part of the problem in this country is we pamper the students too much in music. We accept things without really forcing this kind of an issue anymore. There are wonderful talents coming out of schools, but I find a little too much leniency going on, a little too much independence at too early an age.
When you get involved in that kind of, almost obsessive practicing, I think many people go through a period of rebelling against
Absolutely.
And especially if you have parents who are musicians, you wonder, is this their life or my life that I'm leading? Did you go through a period of rebellion like that yourself?
Absolutely. Fortunately or unfortunately, the issue was clouded for me by my father's death when I was only 19. He was only 47. And the rebellion, rather than being against the parents, was to drop out of music for a year and a half and not have anything to do with it. And then as I recovered from that, I realized that I really did have to go into music. And I really think, as crass as it's going to sound, I started as a violinist. My father was too good. I couldn't stay at it. I went to other things, and I found other people in the family were just too good. I don't think I'd be conducting now if my father was still alive. I think I couldn't have stood the competition.
Too awkward?
No, I think the family ultimately would have come first, and that for me to compete with my father in the same field would have been too hard for me. I hardly knew my father at all anyhow. And all I needed to do was to alienate even more.
You didn't know him because he was busy working.
They were in the studios all day and rehearsing quartets all night. So we never had a normal family relationship, whatever that is. It was very much a professional relationship.
So when you started conducting, did it feel like it was somewhat already in your blood from having watched your father?
Yeah, most of what I still do now, it reminds a lot of people who knew my father's work of my father.
Are you glad about that?
Yeah, because he was good.
My guest is conductor Leonard Slatkin. You took over the St. Louis Symphony in 1979. Before that, you'd been an assistant conductor. You'd been a guest conductor there for a long time as well. Your relationship changes, I figure, with the musicians once you are the conductor and you're more of an authority figure. And I don't know if your relationship needs to be more formal or not.
when I did my first rehearsal as music director, understanding that I'd known these musicians for 7-8 years before taking over, we played whatever piece it was at the very first rehearsal. At some point I stopped, and the first bass player said, "Maestro." And I looked over and I said, "Henry, say that again." And he said, "Maestro, I have a question." I said, "Well, it sounds better than Lenny, but why don't we just keep it at Leonard and we'll exist that way?" And we found a method of communication that was a little bit casual, but done with respect. It was hard. A lot of these people saw me grow up as a conductor. And now I was in the position of possibly being their boss, to the point of having to even dismiss one or two if it came to that. So you're right, it's a difficult transition to make, but it was accomplished well. I had the advantage, of course, of not having to spend 2 or 3 years getting to know the orchestra and them getting to know me. We knew each other. So the quality of sound and things I was going for, they already saw it coming. They knew what it was going to be and how we would work together.
I'm sure there were a lot of changes you wanted to make.
Yeah, not so much personnel, but the repertoire? Kind of sound, the repertoire, certainly.
And also the kind of sound you were looking for?
Yeah. And it took a while, and I think we've done a very good job. I question, of course, the whole thing of ratings. I mean, this is not a sports. Nobody is better than anybody else. And in this country, on any given night, any one of 15 orchestras can be the best, whatever that is. I think consistency is the measure of a fine orchestra. I'd like to think right now that St. Louis is a very consistent orchestra, and more or less night after night, produces quality concerts, excites the audience, makes good music, and keeps a terrific rapport within themselves. You don't find much dissension there. I'm very proud of them. I care for them very deeply, and I'm very happy there.
Any conductor nowadays has to decide how much time they want to spend in the community mm-hmm. that they live in mm-hmm. and that their orchestra is based in, and how much time they want to spend touring the world, guest conducting. What decision have you reached on that balance in your life?
First of all, I do live in St. Louis. I have a home there, and I've been that way for a long time. The St. Louis summer season, unlike other orchestras, doesn't really require me to be there because they are divided between opera and pops concerts and a few other things they do, which have separate facilities. So I spend between 20 and 22 weeks with the orchestra, but it is from the September through May period. Of the 24 subscription concerts, I usually do 14. I do 2 weeks of chamber orchestra. We do between 4 to 6 weeks of touring and various other things that come up. We make between 5 to 6 discs a year for different companies. We have a syndicated radio series, and I have a real good commitment to the orchestra in that sense. Yeah.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us about your life and your music.
It's been a real pleasure
being here. My guest has been conductor Leonard Slatkin. He's the music director of the St. Louis Symphony Orchestra. My name is Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next program, I'll speak with Eileen Simpson. Her new book is titled Orphans, Real and Imaginary. It's part memoir and part social history. So I hope you can join us. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. This is NPR, National Public Radio. From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Coming up, reporter Kennedy Fraser talks about her 20 years following American fashion. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews two recordings of Beethoven's symphony cycles, one conducted by Christopher Hogwood, one by Roger Norrington, both recordings performed on original instruments. And language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg talks about the rise of corporate speak. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio. This is Fresh Air. Our classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz has a review of two recent recordings of Beethoven's symphonies performed on original instruments. Much has changed in music since these works were premiered, including the construction of some of the instruments, their pitch, and bowing techniques.
The original instrument movement has slowly been moving out of its little corner of early music and invading the wide open spaces of the standard repertory. We've been learning that it's not only Josquin and Schütz whose instruments and performance styles we need to know more about, but Mozart and Beethoven, Verdi, and even Gershwin. Within the past year, at least two new Beethoven symphony cycles on authentic instruments have begun to appear. British early music superstar Christopher Hogwood and the Academy of Ancient Music, on Oiseau Lyre, inaugurated their series with the First and Second Symphonies. On Angel, Hogwood's compatriot Roger Norrington with the London Classical Players plunged in a little deeper with Symphonies 2 and 8. Hogwood's appearances with the Academy of Ancient Music, at least the ones I've encountered here, have been disastrous, tedious affairs with playing and singing on a technical level far below that of his recordings. His famous Mozart records, the ones that made him an international celebrity, are lively enough, but they've always struck me as slightly vacuous, blank, low-budget interpretations that offer little more than the curiosity value of hearing Mozart played with gut strings and valveless horns. Since only a handful of the Mozart symphonies are well known to the general public, Hogwood had little real competition. But there are too many good Beethoven performances around for anyone but the most die-hard early instrument enthusiast to be enthused about Hogwood's noodling, aimless versions. Norrington is another story entirely. He's more than an early music specialist. For 15 years, he was the music director of the Kent Opera, and he's a champion of new music, too. In his note for this recording, he tells us that he's chosen to play Beethoven on old instruments, not merely for historical reconstruction. The point, of course, he says, is to make Beethoven sound new, to recapture much of the exhilaration and sheer disturbance that his music certainly generated in his day. Norrington chooses the controversial faster tempos of Beethoven's own metronome markings, which he plays with remarkable flexibility, not mere speed. The inevitable comparison between his Beethoven second and Hogwood's ends in an embarrassing no contest. Listen to Hogwood's bouncy but rhythmically square and finicky run-through of the opening of the last movement. Then listen to the tingling energy, the dramatic surge and lift that Norrington finds in the same passage. Here's Hogwood.
Thank you.
now listen to Norrington and hear the difference. Norrington's players all seem to have some stake in the proceedings. They're not just sawing away. If you want Beethoven on early instruments, the Norrington is clearly the recording to get, especially if you also happen to be in the market for fresh, stimulating new performances of a couple of wonderful but familiar works. Ironically, Norrington's decision to use old instruments ends up being a relatively minor consideration. He's exactly what the early music industry needs more of. A musician with real imagination and flair, someone you might be willing to trust with any kind of music.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix. He's a poet and teaches English and creative writing at the University of Massachusetts in Boston. He reviewed new Beethoven recordings by Christopher Hogwood and Roger Norrington. This is Fresh Air. My guest is fashion writer Kennedy Fraser. She's been writing about the world of fashion and high style for The New Yorker magazine for nearly 20 years. She's covered countless fashion shows and seen skirt lengths go up and down and up again. Her first book, The Fashionable Mind, was a collection of New Yorker essays reflecting her opinions on the subject of fashion from 1970 to 1981. In her new book, Scenes from the Fashionable World, she's collected recent New Yorker pieces where she functions more as the detached and observant reporter. In these pieces, she describes such scenes as a session with fashion photographer Norman Parkinson, the launching of a new perfume, and the clothes, food, and flowers that make up a glittery New York party. Kennedy Fraser came to New York from her native England in 1968. I asked her how she got started writing about fashion.
I always say that it was because I was walking down the corridors of the New Yorker in my miniskirt, and William Shawn, the great editor of the New Yorker, thought that I would be a suitable candidate. He liked my writing, and he saw that I was very interested in style, and I was that generation in England, you know, that was very interested in style. And that was just how it happened. I started out writing book reviews, and then I became the New Yorker's fashion critic when I was 23.
You started writing about fashion in 1970. What was the state of the fashion industry then?
Well, it was a fascinating moment, really, to start writing about fashion. As I say, I came from England, and I was the generation in England that for whom the miniskirt was a tremendous and genuine statement of social change and new sexual mores and women's liberation and all sorts of things. And I came to America, actually I came the day before the Democratic National Convention in 1968. That was my introduction to the life in this country. The women in America when I came were still sort of wearing sort of miniskirts. I mean, they were just above their knees, you know, and they had that kind of vaguely courage style and those huge earrings that looked like golf balls and things. And then all sorts of very sort of eccentric little things going on, like the eccentric byways of style history, such as hot pants, which I actually wore. I mean, it's very hard to believe that, but I did. I actually came to the New Yorker office in my hot pants.
That is hard to believe.
But actually, you know, there I was, as I say, I was young and I was starting out at the New Yorker. I was actually the first person at the New Yorker office to come to the office in trousers. I mean, nobody told me I couldn't do that, but it just turned out that I was a pioneer, you see. And when I first came to New York in 1968, I remember being turned away from the plaza because I was wearing trousers. And we did all these funny tricks of, you know, going out on the streets and rolling up our trousers under our coats so that we could get into restaurants and bars, you know. This all seems a very long time ago, doesn't it?
I once got thrown out of school for wearing culottes.
Now, it's incredible to think that the rules were so rigid in those days.
Yeah. The fashion world seems to keep shifting our sense of what's attractive. One year we think short skirts are attractive, then the next we think long skirts are attractive, colors go in and out. Styles of dresses go in and out. What are some of the techniques for changing what we perceive as being attractive?
Techniques on whose part? Do you mean on the part of the designers or the industry? Or
The industry who pushes the lines each year.
You know, I'm often sort of asked this question about this sort of sinister, you know, industry sort of pushing things on us. I believe that we do have free choice, and I don't, you know, it's a very big business, and it's a very powerful industry, and it does a lot of advertising, but we don't have to, we certainly never have to fall victim to the so-called dictates of the fashion industry, you know. We really can do what we want.
Have you changed your mind about that? I just thought in your book, The Fashionable Mind, that you thought the fashion industry was much more manipulative than you're letting on now. Yeah, I'm going to quote a couple of things that you wrote in earlier years. You wrote, "It's fashion's business to manipulate our memories." And by that, you were talking about how it was the job of the fashion world to make our old clothes seem out of date so that we'd run out and buy new ones. And you wrote, "While the rush is on, fashion is good for business, but it is hardly beneficial to society, talent, or the mind. And in the long run, fashion may prove very bad for life."
Yeah, someone in my in the review of my new book, Scenes from the Fashionable World, said that this is much less ideological than my first book. And perhaps that's true. I think I was a lot angrier. I think we were all a lot angrier 10 or 15 years ago than we are now. Certainly, I was. I was more inclined to see plots. And, you know, again, it's part of being that same generation. I was instinctively iconoclastic. And I don't know where that comes from, but, you know, so many of us were. We instinctively decided that we had to sort of invent a whole new way of running the world, and that's certainly what I did as a young fashion writer. I think probably, you know, I'm more mature and I see things as being somewhat more complex.
Do you consider yourself part of the fashion press?
I've always had this odd role as sort of an outsider in that world, and I suppose I am a part of the fashion press. Although, I actually haven't written a fashion column for the New Yorker for many years. I think it's about 5 years now, a fashion column as such. But in these, I just happen to be in the world of fashion. but I'm functioning as a reporter, which is very different from being a fashion reporter.
Are there ways that you think the fashion press is expected to hype new fashions?
Well, I don't really know how it works for other people, and I wouldn't like to venture an opinion on that. But I suspect that some of them sort of think that they have to go along with prevailing opinion more than they actually have to. But then it's very hard to develop one's own opinions. It takes a considerable effort. You know, I remember when I used to cover the fashion shows and everyone was saying, oh, this is important, this is important. They were all sort of, you know, there's a tremendous kind of group enthusiasm and a tremendous impulse to describe whatever, to agree on what's important that season. And it was a tremendous mental effort for me to say, well, no, that may be important to them, but it's not what's important to me.
Is the world of fashion a good place to study values in women's roles and how ideas are changing?
Oh, absolutely, yes. Of course it is. I mean, it is no more or less than life itself. And at least, you know, it's the external part of life. There's a whole other part of life that has nothing to do with what sort of car we have or where we live or any of that, thank God. But it's a very, very important part of life. And I was just thinking, I mean, this is a very funny moment for fashion. You know, there's a lot of talk about the miniskirt again. Just at this moment when, you know, we're going to, you know, they're talking about appointing this man to the Supreme Court who's so anti-abortion. And, you know, when there's so much reluctance to engage in sexual activities because of the fear of AIDS. So that the miniskirt, that was this thing that originally sprung up as a completely spontaneous expression of social change, is now being revived in a completely, you know, artificial way, really. Well, artificial, except that I think what it has to do with a certain kind of visual change and the need for visual change. People's legs have perhaps been hidden for too long, and it's time to expose them. And that's you know, the need for visual change is a real thing in fashion. It's not only a question of what things mean on the deepest level.
Would you ever wear a miniskirt again?
I think perhaps I might leave it to those who are now starting out.
Okay. Kennedy Fraser, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
Kennedy Fraser covers fashion for The New Yorker magazine. Her new book is called Scenes from the Fashionable World.
Oh, I'm putting on my top hat, tying up my white tie, brushing off my tail. I'm dooting up my shirt front, putting in my shirt stud, polishing my nails.
The Boswell sisters singing Irving Berlin's Top Hat, White Tie, and Tails. This is Fresh Air. You can hear full coverage of today's news on All Things Considered. Robert Siegel, who co-hosts the program, is joining us from Washington. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Jerry.
Well, it's day two of Oliver North's testimony.
Mm-hmm. And Oliver North has been giving his account of why he used some monies that we'd thought weren't his to use. We'll have a report on that and other items that came up in today's testimony. Also, an interview with Saul Bellow, Nobel laureate author, about his new novel, More Die of Heartbreak.
What else do you have for us tonight?
Ah, well, we'll hear about this man. That is saxophonist, in London they'd call him saxophonist, Henry Threadgill, whom we'll hear about.
Terrific. Sounds good. Thank you, Robert. Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Making it in the corporate world often requires mastering a new tongue, corporate speak. Our language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg has these thoughts.
A couple of weeks ago, the California Public Utilities Commission ordered the Pacific Bell Corporation to discontinue its leadership development training program. The program is nicknamed Croning after its developer, Charles Crone, a management consultant and a self-proclaimed disciple of the early 20th century mystic G.I. Gurdjieff. Croning has already been offered to thousands of employees at DuPont, Scott Paper, and Crown Zellerbach. In the course of being croned, it turns out, you have to learn to jettison large parts of your outmoded, low-tech English vocabulary. What used to be called agreement is now alignment. What used to be goals are now end-state visions. Agendas are now processes. You can get an idea of how all of this has affected the overall intellectual climate at Pac Bell from this excerpt from its 1987 business plan. Where individuals and teams are aligned with purpose and standards of achievement which provide them stretch and are given the free space to generate new capabilities, they gain personal growth and creativity. 15 years ago, you heard this kind of talk mostly from the people who accosted you in airline terminals. Nowadays, it's endemic in the field of corporate training, or as its practitioners call it, human resources development. In recent years, the corporate training people have taken up sensitivity training, transactional analysis, EST, and just about every other balmy fad to come down the pike. As a result, half the middle managers in America now sound as if they'd spent too much time in the hot tub. Take this excerpt from a recent ad for a corporate training program. Performax has the solution with Winning Lifestyles, a multifaceted wellness program designed to evaluate and suggest balanced improvements in all areas of wellness. What can be going through the minds of hard-headed executives when they buy into this linguistic shell game? It's as if they had decided that they won't be able to catch up with the Japanese until every ordinary English word has been replaced by a psychobabble equivalent, and every corporation has a language all its own. Already, executives at Crown Zellerbach are complaining that meetings held in the new Crone talk are literally unintelligible to outsiders. In fact, Crone and his fellows would readily admit that this is exactly what they're after. They are out to create genuine corporate cultures so that when you go to work for Pac Bell or Crown Zellerbach, you can feel as if you're taking on a whole way of life. Creating a private vocabulary is an obvious step in the process. A secret language is the mark of every group that expects to command the emotional loyalty of its members, a religious cult, a motorcycle gang, even a simple teenage clique. Why is there so much of the old cults in the new corporate cultures? Thinking about this, I couldn't help recalling Max Weber, who wrote The Protestant Ethic and the Spirit of Capitalism 80 years ago. Defenders of the free market system like to say that the success of capitalism depends on nothing more than an appeal to the rational self-interest of the individual. You scratch my back and I'll scratch yours. But Weber argued that capitalism required a religious foundation, which is why it first emerged after the Reformation in Northern Europe. But the Protestant ethic has worn a little thin in modern America, and in any case, it was clearly better suited to societies of merchants and shopkeepers than to the vast corporations of the post-industrial world. The new economic man needs an ethic fit for him, so that he can feel the same attachment to Pac Bell that he once felt to the old family firm. That's where the corporate training consultants come in, with packaged spiritual renewal under their arms. Everything would be just fine if only the unspiritual folks at the Public Utilities Commission hadn't thrown a wet blanket over the whole affair. Good wellness to them all.
Language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg is a linguist associated with the Center for the Study of Language and Information at Stanford University. Here's what's coming up on tomorrow's show. Tomorrow I'll speak with entomologist David Brody. He has a second career as a bug wrangler, catching and choreographing cockroaches and other insects for movies like Creepshow and The Believers. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker will review the first Grateful Dead album in 7 years, and film critic Stephen Schiff will review Inner Space, the new Steven Spielberg production starring Dennis Quaid and Martin Short. So I hope you can join us. And we want to welcome a station new to Fresh Air, KCUR, in Kansas City, Missouri. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Today's program was produced by Fred Landerl, with producers Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Ed Dougherty is the production assistant. Our engineer is Ron Barron. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. Fresh Air's theme music is composed and performed by Jackie Byard. My name's Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.